This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a labor expert walks us through the current job market and labor changes we might see in the future. Now, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in Congress reached a deal aimed at reducing gun violence over the weekend. The framework would provide more funding for states to create red flag laws, increase background checks for gun buyers under 21, and step up financial support for community mental health clinics. There's still a lot to do before it has a chance of becoming law, and reaction has been mixed. Some gun safety advocates saying it doesn't go far enough, some gun rights supporters opposing red flag laws in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this potential for action on gun laws and school safety? Do you think this could reduce gun violence? Are there other policies, that you want to see Congress take up to deal with gun violence in the United States? What do you think about the idea of red flag laws in particular? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Adam Winkler is professor at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law. He's also author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, this is still in some ways early stages. How significant is what we're seeing so far from this bipartisan group of Senate negotiators?
Well, there's two ways to measure it. One, how significant will it be in terms of reducing gun violence? Well, I think these are measures in the right direction. Most of them are pretty moderate, and so I wouldn't expect it to have a big impact, certainly not immediately, on gun violence numbers. The second way to measure it is, you know, what does passage of this bill mean for gun policy in America more generally? And if we can break the logjam that has prevented any new consideration of significant reform for over 10 years since the Newtown shooting, well, then this might be a breakthrough that could lead potentially to future reforms. Again, maybe of a small and moderate character, but ones that move the ball a little bit forward down the field each time.
We got an email from Matt in Madison who says, because nothing happened after Sandy Hook, he writes, I'm convinced that we aren't going to do anything now. Matt goes on, Republicans will water anything down. States will then feed on the carcass of gun regulations. I hope I'm wrong, but nothing in the past indicates this time will be any different. Matt, skeptical there, clearly, that anything significant is going to happen.
Well, it's hard to argue with Matt's skepticism. I mean, it's based in reality. We've seen, sort of been to this space time and time again, and only to walk away disappointed, and with the gun violence problem only seeming to get worse. It does seem that reports from Washington suggest that there may be more momentum than we have seen in a long time, and it's also the case that the particular measures that are being considered are reasonably moderate, not likely to have a significant burden on law-abiding gun owners, not going to have the big impact on criminal violence and reducing gun violence that maybe some gun safety advocates had hoped for. But part of the gun safety advocates' political problem in recent years has been aiming too high for things like bans on assault weapons or high-capacity magazines, things that are certain to get the gun owners really riled up and to increase the opposition to their proposals.
One of the most directly gun-related parts of this plan would be the red flag law. Some states have these already. Florida, among them, people point to as a Republican state that passed a red flag law. This, as I understand it, this plan wouldn't impose a federal red flag law. It would help states who want to do it. Can you talk about red flag laws, their potential impact?
Yeah, red flag laws are a relatively recent phenomenon. They've been passed, though, in a number of states, both red states and blue states, and they provide family members, for instance, who see someone who is in crisis but has possession of firearms, this enables them to go to court and just temporarily take away those firearms. Those firearms will be eventually returned to the person, but it brings in the judicial process and a little oversight and supervision, which can be a really helpful thing when you see young people in particular who are struggling with the onset of mental illness or having other struggles, but they're armed. Maybe this can help reduce some gun violence, maybe by reducing suicide or reducing some mass shootings. Again, it's not going to have a big effect in the sense that it's hard to predict when someone's going to be violent, but it does provide that opportunity. One of the big criticisms of red flag laws is that the person who is affected is generally not involved in the process, and so they don't get a right to state their view and to appear in court. So far, courts have upheld these laws as constitutionally permissible. But you could see why there is some opposition there.
Right. The Wisconsin Republican Party state convention passed a resolution back in April opposing red flag laws. They labeled them as gun confiscation laws disguised as gun violence prevention, said they were unconstitutional prior restraint. So Republicans control the legislature in Wisconsin. They will likely continue to do so after the elections. So if the federal government passes a law helping red flags laws get passed in states, but states don't want them, does it really make much of a difference?
Not going to make a difference at all in many states. The states that are really opposed to having red flag laws will just not form them. The federal proposal that we've seen so far would be one that only provides grants, funding for states, and provides some framework for them to set up these laws. But if a state is dead set opposed to these laws, they won't be required to do so. There has been some pushback from House Democrats to change that, to make it so that there is a federal red flag law where you could go to a federal court in any state in the nation and seek one of these extreme risk protection orders. But we'll have to see how that shakes out when the details of the deal really come out.
Talking to Adam Winkler from the UCLA School of Law, author of the book Gunfight, looking at a tentative deal in the U.S. Senate on some gun violence prevention efforts, school safety, mental health, also part of the picture here. Now, also included in this, changing the way background checks work for people under 21, as I understand it, Adam, taking into account juvenile criminal records. What are we seeing there?
Well, their proposal does mean that they're going to improve the background check system by including juvenile mental health and criminal justice records for those purchasing guns before the age of 21. This would be a moderate improvement in the sense that, look, if someone has a record that does create problems or suspicions that they will likely be violent with a firearm, if they have one of these predictable variables in their background, then it's good to get that into the background check system. This is going to be a difficult one to be fully implemented, though. Many states do not collect this data as a matter of course, and the NICS background check system for federal gun transfers requires state data reporting into the federal system. The federal government doesn't have its own mechanism to do it. So to the extent the states don't already have good systems in place to gather and report this kind of information, the background check system won't be as effective as it might otherwise be.
There have also been some headlines about the boyfriend loophole when it comes to gun purchases and domestic violence. What do people mean by that?
Well, current law, under the current federal law, bars people who are domestic abusers from possessing firearms. However, that only applies to a domestic abuser who is also a spouse. And so gun safety advocates have been pushing for years to expand the definition of who could be included in this domestic abuser prohibition, and including those who are in a dating relationship with the particular person. And so this is a good expansion of the prohibition on domestic abusers, in that we know that there are plenty of people who are together who are not married but pose the same domestic violence problems. And one of the best predictors for someone using firearms against their significant other or partner is a history of domestic abuse. So these are definitely the people we want to keep away from having guns.
It can be tough to thread the needle between something that's going to be, as you say, effective in reducing gun violence and something that'll get enough political support to pass and that'll pass Supreme Court muster. Do you think there are any missed opportunities to do something that meets all three of those criteria in what we're seeing from the Senate?
Well, Rob, that's a great point you make about the Supreme Court and the Second Amendment, because so far the Second Amendment has not been a big barrier to gun safety reform in the courts. Courts have mostly upheld gun laws, but the Supreme Court seems to be on the precipice of a major change on the Second Amendment. There's a big Second Amendment case coming down any day now from the Supreme Court where they're likely to raise the constitutional bar for any gun safety law. And I think that if this Senate deal had included some of the things that Democrats were pushing for, like bans on assault weapons or bans on high-capacity magazines, it's very likely that would have resulted in a constitutional challenge and one that might very well have proven successful to overturn those laws. So one of the things I think is important about this Senate deal is that it is a series of moderate measures. Gun violence is only going to be reduced in America by a series of moderate measures, not by these big, high-profile things like taking away assault weapons that as you point out, may really just run into ultimate problems in the courts.
Adam Winkler is with us, Second Amendment expert, professor at the UCLA School of Law, with us today for a look at a bipartisan deal in Congress on red flag laws, mental health funding, school safety, resources, all efforts to reduce the impact of gun violence, gun homicide, and suicide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the deal, what you've heard about it so far? Do you want to see Congress pass something? If so, what? Do you think this doesn't go far enough? Are there other measures you'd like to see? Do you worry about some of the elements, like red flag laws? Should we have those kind of laws here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about a bipartisan deal, tentative deal, at least in the U.S. Senate, aimed at reducing gun violence. Adam Winkler stays with us from UCLA's School of Law. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you hope gets passed by Congress? What do you fear could be passed by Congress? What, if any, changes would you want to see when it comes to gun laws in the United States? Red flag laws, one thing on the table here. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. Looking at the rest of the bill, Adam, some school safety measures, some mental health funding. How significant is that?
Well, these are good things. I mean, it depends on what the actual funding is and what is actually being, how much funding there is for school safety. It's clear we do have a very big problem in this country. We have an armed society for good or ill. And one of the ills of having an armed society is that people who really want to engage in violence have a ready means to do so. Those guns are here to stay when we have a right to bear arms. And so having better security in places where vulnerable people gather is an important part of the overall picture of sort of suite of reforms that you need for gun safety reduction. And mental health is a particularly important area because it's an area where in American public services, we've really reduced the amount of health care funding and health care services out there. And to the extent that we see gun violence as one problem that is sometimes associated with mental health, I should be clear that not always and not often, but it's something that can be helpful and might even be useful in providing mental health services to people who are considering suicide, which is, of course, the vast majority of gun deaths every year, even though it's the problem that we almost rarely talk about.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Appleton. Dan, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I would have liked to see them raise the purchase age to 21 across the board. Just there's, what is it, 6 and 9 in the last, since 2018, were 18, 19-year-olds. I don't think there's a practical way to ban assault rifles or high-capacity magazines. The Clintons didn't do it, and there's like 20 million of them afloat.
I gotcha. Dan, thanks for the call. This was something people were talking about, Adam, that didn't end up in this deal, changing the age to purchase firearms from 18 to 21 for all firearms, some people said, or semi-automatic weapons or the sort of loosely defined assault weapon category.
Well, this would have been, I think, a worthwhile reform. I've written for a few years about the importance of raising the gun age. And this is not based on anything other than good brain science, like what we know about the brain and how the brain processes information in terms of long-term consequences, risk-taking behavior. We know that the brain really changes when the brain gets a little bit older. And so to the extent that we could move people from 18 to 21 to get their hands on firearms, I think that would be very helpful, not only for reducing some of the mass shootings, because I don't think there's much data to support that mass shootings overall are committed by particularly young people, even though the caller, Dan, was right that a couple recent ones are young people. But young people, of course, are much more apt to commit suicide with firearms than people who are more established age. And it might be the kind of thing that can help in that space, too.
Thanks a lot for that call. We got an email from Adrian in Wauwatosa who says, "My sister died by suicide 4 years ago thanks to easy access to a firearm. Adrian goes on, had there been some red flag indicating her suicidality, selling her that gun that day may have deterred her access to the surest way of her death. You just mentioned suicide being the leading cause of death by firearm. How could red flag laws in particular impact that, Adam?
Well, the idea of the red flag laws is that where family members who might be the most likely to know that someone's going through a crisis, it gives them some ability to go to court and say, hey, this person is a threat. They're a danger to themselves and to others. We already allow people to go to courts and get people to be put on a 72-hour hold. We take all of their liberty away, right? We put them in a 72-hour hold if they're going through a crisis. This is basically something similar that family members can use and would take the firearms away for, say, a month. We'll have to see what the federal law and conditions are, but red flags often will do something like limit the guns for a month. And that kind of temporary confiscation can really help where family members see someone in crisis. We talk about mass shootings, but well over 60% of gun deaths every year are suicide, and we know from the data that if we can reduce access to firearms by people who contemplate suicide, it's much more likely that their suicide attempt will be unsuccessful and that they'll go on to have potentially rich and full lives.
Adrian, thank you so much for sharing that, and so sorry for the loss of your sister. Let's go back to our callers now. David is with us in Grand Marsh. David, hello.
Hey, hello. Great topic, and I just wanted to share some experiences that I've had, you know, living in different countries, how they approach guns, and it's so different. And I want to say something, but I don't want to offend anybody. But it seems like different cultures, different countries, they value the safety of their kids a lot more than we do. And I'm not saying that you know, American parents don't value their kids' lives. I'm telling you that American society doesn't value their kids' lives and the safety of their kids like other countries do. And if I could just say that, you know, the inactivity of our government into not addressing this sooner is an embarrassment. It really is.
David, thanks for the call. Adam, what do you think?
Well, you know, I've never really studied whether we value children less than other countries, but it does certainly seem like that we are not as motivated to act when we see a lot of children dying that one might hope we would be. But at the same time, I think it's a difficult issue because David makes some great points, but there's also the point that, you know, for many gun owners in America, they believe that the answer is more guns. That the answer to providing safety in a community and a society that where there's already 400 million guns, the answer is in arming teachers and arming people on the street so that they can defend themselves. And whether you agree with that perspective or not, I think it's worthwhile to recognize that some people do genuinely believe it, and that makes them very reluctant to agree to gun safety reform laws when they think, hey, the criminals are all going to still have guns, and there'll just be no one around to protect them.
Thanks for that call. Mary joins us next in Eau Claire. Mary, hello.
Hello. I want to point out that I think the Republicans are duping us with this watered-down bill because if it passes and there is no significant reduction in gun violence, they will say, see, regulations don't work, and we're going to be stuck with this watered-down bill for another 3 or 4 decades. I suppose it's better than nothing, but this idea that it's a first step to better regulations, I think, is baloney.
Mary, thanks for the call. Adam?
Well, again, Mary's cynicism, it's hard to argue with based on what we've seen in American politics lately. The one way I think about it is that, look, our political system is broken. We can't get Congress to pass meaningful reform in almost any area of law, much less in one so controversial as guns and gun policy, that to reduce gun violence will require not just one simple solution, but a suite of reforms that try to target little pieces of the gun violence problem in all its different ways, from suicide to mass shooting to criminal violence to accidents. it takes a different approach for all of those things. And so having at least opening up the possibility that we can have more serious conversations about what we need to do to reform guns seems to me to be a worthwhile chance to take. But Mary's cynicism is certainly well-earned in American politics recently.
Mary, thanks for the call. Adam, I'm seeing some reporting that Republicans, after these last couple of mass shootings, some Republicans in Congress and in the House and the Senate are feeling some constituent pressure to do something. Maybe not everything, maybe not huge changes, but to be seen doing something. Do you think there's any kind of change going on here at that local level that politicians are feeling the heat?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be one of the real questions that comes out of this reform. If it passes the Senate, and which would require at least 10 Republican votes, what does the November election tell us about this vote? Do those who have supported this legislation get voted out? Do those who supported this legislation find that there's their electoral chances have been reduced significantly? That the NRA says, "Hey, oppose this candidate," and promises that there's going to be a backlash with taking away your endorsements and things like that? Well, then we might see that Republicans who support this bill will never support another one in the future. So I think it's one of the real interesting questions to see what happens if it passes in terms of, is there that kind of political backlash?
And just briefly, do you think it's likely that this is going to end up passing?
Well, you know, tea leaves are best left for making tea, probably, Rob. You know, predicting the future is never my strong suit. I've got a pretty bad track record. So I don't know. It does seem like there's more momentum than ever. But I guess I'll be with Dan and Mary and some of your other callers who had a little cynicism about whether this will get passed or not. I certainly wouldn't bet my house on it.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Adam Winkler, professor at the UCLA School of Law, author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He was with us today to talk about a new bipartisan plan in the U.S. Senate involving some gun regulation changes, school safety and mental health funding, and what comes next as lawmakers work to pass a bill into law. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Kate talks to the chairs of Wisconsin's Democratic and Republican parties for a look at priorities in this year's midterm elections, gun laws, and the latest from the January 6th committee. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network.